This is the U of Vic Military Oral History Program, interview with Charles Gordon Owen, recorded on March 12, 2015, at 207 1791 Rockland Avenue, Victoria, home of Charles Gordon Owen. Interviewed by Ethan Mayer. Major Gordon Owen, do I have permission to record this interview?
Yes.
Okay. Can you please state your name, including both given name and surname?
Fine. Charles Gordon Owen.
Perfect. Where did you grow up?
In several places. I started in Los Angeles, California, Oakland, California, Portland, Oregon, and from 1940 in Vancouver, where I attended grade school, junior high, high school, and UBC.
So when you moved to Canada, was it 1940?
1940. It was, I guess, October 1940.
Okay. And where were you living at the time of your enlistment?
In the regular forces.
I
had a reserve background before then. Mm-hmm. But at the time I went in the regular forces, I was living in Prince Rupert, B.C.
Prince Rupert, B.C. And what age were you at the time when you enlisted?
21.
Okay. Why did you join the Army?
I was working building a pulp mill as the assistant mechanical superintendent, making lots of money but not having much fun in Rupert. It is our main place. Mm. And we had almost finished the Columbia Cellulose Company, and our next project was going to be east of Edmonton, building an oil processing plant. And I had been told that we were going to, that was my next job. And the Korean War had broken out, and I was in the militia in Prince Rupert. And I said, heck with this. I'm not going to Edmonton or anywhere like that. I'll go to Korea instead. So I wrote a letter to the Department of National Defense. And the next thing you know, I'm a second lieutenant in the Canadian Army. And know where I was being trained? East of Edmonton. A place I was trying to avoid. It's ironic.
Did any of your friends join with you at the time?
No.
No? Just you went by yourself?
A lot of people in Prince Rupert joined, but none of my friends from Prince Rupert, mm-hmm. but a lot of my friends from Vancouver joined at the same time and went to different regiments.
Mm-hmm. Were there any other careers that, at the time, interested you besides the Army?
Well, yeah, I had a very good future as a junior engineer with the construction company building pulp mills, tank farms, etc. Mm-hmm. That was booming business. I would have probably retired from them instead of the Army. The Korean War had opened up.
Okay. So you said you started your first training in Edmonton, that's correct?
Outside of Edmonton, outside Wainwright.
Oh, in Wainwright, okay. And that's when you first started your training for...
Well, that's with the regular force.
Yeah,
I was already trained.
Right.
In militia, COTC, I spent my summers training on the Canadian Officer Training Plan. So I was already qualified as an officer when I went to the regular force.
Do you think you could explain that part to me, the whole militia part? I wasn't aware of that.
Oh.
Yeah.
There, across Canada, mm-hmm. there are thousands of men and women that belong to militia units, reserve units. They train in the summertime, they train probably once or twice a week during the winter, mm-hmm. In the evenings, they train on weekends, and a lot of them take temporary positions with the regular when there are vacancies in certain parts of the world. It's not unusual for militia people to be posted to Afghanistan or Iraq, or not very many of them, but if they're looking for full-time employment, they get another special training course to bring them up to regular standards. Mm-hmm. And then they go away for a year or so at a time.
Okay. In the militia force, what weapons did you primarily train with in regards to rifles?
Well, you have the same rifles as the regular force.
Okay. Well,
in my day, it was the...
Lee Enfield,
3s, 4s, and 5s, mm-hmm. plus Bren guns, plus so on and so on.
And was there like LMGs, light machine guns?
Oh, yes. Same equipment the regular force had.
Okay.
Just not as much of it.
Yeah. And in the regular force, did you train with explosives, like mines and...
I am a pioneer officer, which is a trained field engineer in the infantry. I taught mines, explosives, and in Korea, my job as pioneer officer was booby traps, put them in, take them out, mines, put them in, take them out, anything to make the going of trucks and troops easier, plus potable water, and then we were on demand more than just our own unit. You've got booby traps, you know, people want them taken out now, mm-hmm. You've got mines put in front of you, and the normal soldier doesn't know how to handle those. And I personally trained my pioneers, but they had at least 3 years of experience before I took them to Korea. So they were very well trained, and I never lost a man, except myself.
That's it.
Except myself.
So, in that sense then, you train for patrols, correct?
We were on patrol almost every night. Mm-hmm. It was routine for pioneers to leave after dark and come in before sunset. Mm-hmm. Sometimes the job we discovered was so dangerous to do at dark that I just canceled the job and go out in broad daylight and take my chances that we wouldn't be seen. I did that a lot.
How did you train, though, for these patrols? Was there any training?
Oh, yes. Yeah. You train in Canada. Yeah. The summer training camps that the regular troops go to, that is it. They're practicing all sorts of warfare. You'll spend a couple of months, 3 months in the summer doing that, then take your annual leave, and then when you're back in barracks for the winter, you start other kinds of training. Your regular force is constantly training. Mm-hmm. When I commanded a company group in Germany, we had armored personnel carriers. I'd quite often get a troop of tanks attached, a couple of helicopters attached. We'd practice. I'd write the exercises, and we'd go out and practice them.
So you wrote the exercises?
I'd write the exercises.
Did you write some of the exercises for the patrols in Korea as well?
No. That by the time you get to Korea, you're not training anymore. You're practicing the art of war.
But I mean, for training prior to Korea, did you write the exercises as well?
Yes, I did that. Second lieutenant, all ranks.
Yeah.
And in some cases, there are books or manuals. You adapt to the ground you've got. But you're constantly training and practicing.
And you learned your patrols and proper mandate from a lieutenant before you? Is that how it worked?
No, I learned it in training officer training at university.
Okay.
You go to summer camps, mm-hmm. where you go through the regular training and practice. And with officers that had, at that time, most of them had World War II experience. So they could just pass that on. Training is a constant thing.
Yeah.
There's never really an end to training. Even the regular force, when I was stationed in Germany, we have about four times a year big major exercises. And then you'd have emergency rollouts, 2 or 3 in the morning. You know, the Russians have declared war, everybody gets to your stations. Mm-hmm. And they can run pretty smoothly if you've got a well trained unit.
Yeah. Besides Edmonton, the base though at Wainwright, what other base did you train at prior to overseas deployment?
Petawawa. Mm-hmm. And that was 1951 I joined, and I went overseas in January of 1953. So between that, I went to Wainwright 3 times, Petawawa 3 times, Rivers, Manitoba for a parachute course, once before I went to Korea. I guess those are the only, also Camp Borden. Mm-hmm. Camp Borden. Oh, and the engineer school at Chilliwack, of course, where I became a field engineer, and that gave me a double qualifications of infantry and field engineer. So I could be the pioneer officer.
Okay. So you felt like before you went to Korea, you felt your training was more than adequate for any situation?
Oh, it was. I'd had 2 years previous to that, in the Canadian Officer Training Corps, I had been with a battery, an anti-aircraft battery in Prince Rupert. Plus, I was in the reserves before I went to university. While I was in high school, I was with the Reserve Army of the Seaforth Islanders in Vancouver. Plus, during the war, every high school boy was in cadet corps, and you had training from 14 on to the day you graduated. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I was quite adequately trained.
That sounds like it. I know you've already said this just for the record, though. When were you first deployed overseas?
I think it was February the 2nd, 1953. And that was to Korea.
Did you stop off in Japan on the way?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. How long was your stay in Japan?
You 30 days.
30 days. And when you arrived in Korea, can you describe any first impressions or anything memorable?
We left Hiroshima, where we were stationed at, on arrival in Japan. We were acclimatized. It was beautiful, warm weather. And the military had two old Chinese coastal freighters that were just tourist boats, really. And we split the battalion into two halves. And most of the battalion went on one of them. And Second Lieutenant George, forgotten his last name, and I were the only two officers on the other one. And we get on this, what is a luxury, really a luxury, a steamer to go to Korea. I couldn't believe it. We sat in the lounge, pushed a button on the wall, and a Chinese servant would come and ask what you wanted. The drinks were tuppence, whatever you want, it was tuppence. I guess it was 3 days from Hiroshima to Korea. Landed at the port of Busan, but on entering Busan Harbor was really an awakening. It was a dirty, filthy harbor. The war had erupted around the original Chinese attack. It pushed everyone down to the area of Busan Harbor, and there were bodies still floating in the water. I mean, it was an awakening. You get off this luxury boat and reform on the docks, get on a train where the seats literally were converted orange crates, boxes, and every time the train stopped, there wasn't a dining car as such. They'd open one of the cars on the train and issue hard rations, and then you get back on the train. There were thousands of people along the tracks, and when the train stopped, to keep these thousands of civilians from approaching anyone on the train, there were riflemen get off and fired shots down to keep the tracks, keep people away from the trains. And it was effective. And we arrived in a staging area behind the lines to get ourselves organized. And we were there for, I guess, about, battalion was there for a month, but I immediately, with my pioneers, went up to the Royal 22nd Regiment. They were in the line, and to find out what their pioneer officer was doing and get indoctrinated. So I had an extra month of experience that the battalion didn't have, and I knew by the time came in the line, I knew where all the mines and booby traps were, and I could get around and see them and take the men around and so on. And,
so your men came after you?
No, my men came with me.
Okay.
Yeah. So the battalion came up into the line to the same position occupied by the Royal 22nd Regiment about a month later.
Okay. Yeah. And when you got to the staging area, did you do any training in Korea at all? Just to, like, refresh?
I did not, because we were actually in the line. We went right from the staging area to an active war position with the Pioneer Platoon of the Royal 22nd Regiment. So we were into it. Mm-hmm. The battalion did some training in the rear area with patrols and rifle ranges and so on, until they were brought up into the line.
Yeah, okay. You can explain to me the rotation process, like when you and your battalion went up to the use of the Royal 22nd. How did the rotation work?
Well, the rotation, you take over a company area already occupied by an infantry company of the Royal 22nd. You'd go up onto the position with your men. They would be prepared to leave. There'd be a quick handover between platoon commanders, the company commander, and then that company would be taken off the hill as quick as possible. This would happen with you have four infantry companies, plus in the rear areas, you have your immediate fighting forces that are required to support the actual front line, guys in front line. And then behind that, about 5 miles back, you have what we call B echelon, which would have the adjutant of the unit. He's not required in the front lines or in the immediate action area behind the front lines. Your mobile laundry and bath units, you don't want them up in the front. your ordnance and maintenance facilities, so on. Those will all be back in fairly safe area. Not totally safe, but fairly safe compared to being at the front. You don't normally get shelled by artillery. You do normally get shelled by artillery if you're at the front, though.
How long did this process take? A couple hours? A couple days?
No, a handover would start with, usually with a commanding officer going up there a couple of days early. You'd be sighted with the commanding officer of the unit going out. There'd be one or two guides, people taken up early. Make it a smooth handover. You want to be guided in, and the fellas already on the ground don't need a guide out, though.
Did you go up early yourself? With
Well, I went. Yeah, a month early.
Right, you just said my mistake.
No, it's all right. I know my fine platoon went in a month early.
Okay, yeah. What were your first impressions of the men that you were replacing? Is there any...
They're happy to get out. Oh, yeah, they were disciplined.
Yeah.
They'd had a few casualties. And they were finishing their tour of duty in Korea. So they were, when they got pulled out this time, they were going straight to the rear and going home and getting on a boat. And yeah, they're, I know the platoon commander I replaced was very, very thorough. We went on patrols and he was not taking any chances on getting shot or artillery or making any noise. Very professional, and they warned us that, you know, not the slightest squeak. Anyway, it was
When you went, can you explain to me the standard military equipment that you were issued?
Well,
just with the basics, not everything. But.
Well, I took to Korea, a couple of sets of battle dress, a couple of sets of coveralls, normal undergarments, socks. I had one pair of boots, pair of shoes, shirts, ties, helmets, obviously. Mm-hmm. Now, a lot of that stuff I left in a suitcase with the quartermaster sergeant, who, again, is another organization in B echelon, and he wasn't required at the front unless the company commander needed him for something. And so in the front, he'd actually... FSOD, Field Service Olive Drab uniform. Today they replaced it with camouflage clothing, and you'd have one or two sets of that, depending on the weather. And
weapons and like grenades and.
I had a 9mm pistol with a couple of mags of ammunition, but there was more available. Each platoon position had maybe 20 boxes of hand grenades and lots of ammunition, plus a rocket launcher, plus three light machine guns. But by the time my battalion got there, we'd accumulated a lot of. We had extra machine guns, we had extra mortars. If I remember, our machine gun platoon had 50 caliber machine guns, which we were not entitled to, but they picked them up along the way. But then when you went to get ammo for them, the ammo depot, even though at an ammo depot, you don't really need paper. They keep track of things, but ammo is issued on request. Bang, I need, and for very good reason. You can't have a slowdown if you need stuff right away. But when we went down to get 50 caliber ammunition, you're not entitled to it because you're not supposed to have 50 caliber guns. So I can remember one day going along with my Jeep. I saw a Jeep parked on the side of the road where the trailer was full of 50 caliber ammo. Well, if they're entitled to it, they can go back and get some more. So I couldn't see anyone around, so I had my driver unhook the trailer, hook it onto my Jeep, took it up to the machine gun officer, said, get this trailer up and hide it fast. No, that goes on all the time.
That was good though. Was there any faults that you found in your equipment, your weapons, like anything that that didn't operate functionally well in the field?
Normally, the answer would be no, because it kept clean. But on the night of the 3rd of May, 1953, I was doing some explosive demolition work on Charlie Company, 3RCR, and they were taking an awful heavy beating by Chinese with casualties, and I was at Doug Banton's platoon. That was the number eight platoon, and while I was there, the company commander ordered him to take his platoon to rescue a fighting patrol that had been ambushed in front of number 7 platoon. And I said, oh, geez, okay. And then he said, Gord, my pistol's not working. It's frozen. He said, can I borrow yours? I said, sure. So I gave him my pistol, which was... unfortunately, he just got over the edge of the platoon, the 4th platoon, and they were all killed. But, of course, I didn't know that. I'm 100 yards behind that. And later on, while I was fighting Chinese, I had to manually close the pistol, and that froze altogether. Mm. But I put 5 hand grenades in my pockets before I went out, so those were effective.
Very effective.
Very effective.
Did you think I read some stuff about the Lee Enfield that it wasn't, that some Canadian soldiers preferred the M1 Garand over?
No, the Enfield wasn't an automatic weapon. You had to bolt action and feed each shot. The American Garand was a 10-shot magazine. So once you loaded it, just all you had to do was pull the trigger. It wasn't quite as accurate at long range as the Lee Enfield. But in Korea, the ranges you were using your weapon at were 100 yards or less, so you didn't need the 1,000-yard capacity of the Lee Enfield. Mm-hmm. It was a very accurate weapon, and it was easier to keep clean than the Garand. But I know some soldiers picked up American Tommy guns and so on, and because they preferred them to the Sten gun, which was eventually replaced.
Did you ever replace any of your guns, or anybody in your platoon ever want to?
Not my men, no.
Was there a rule against that, or just out of preference?
When you're in the front lines, usually most of the people are using issue weapons issue. Some soldiers had preference for. I know our snipers picked up infrared material from the Americans, and so instead of using just an ordinary telescope and a on a Lee Enfield, they had the American sniper rifles with infrared, and they could see the movement of heat movement, and that would help them at night an awful lot. And then in the daytime, they'd use their normal issued sniper rifle.
What was your favorite weapon?
9mm.
Yeah. And the Koreans, what was their weapons of choice or use?
Whatever they could find. Usually, they were loaded with used American equipment.
Mm-hmm. Did you guys ever, were ever issued armored vests? I know they came in 1952 and after the, no, never.
Never even heard of them. About 55, 50, somewhere in there.
Oh, okay.
I never, yeah, good idea.
Oh, I read somewhere that the other day they had them issued in the...
The Air Force had stuff for their gunners and so on in the air.
Yeah.
But we didn't on the ground. It was, when did I, it was, I don't even think I saw one until after I'd retired. And that was 78.
How about helmets?
Yeah, well, we had the old suit plate British helmets, which we wore those. It was
we required to wear them?
Required to wear them. You're in the front, you're wearing them, period. $25 fine for men and a couple of orderly officers, two extra officers, and you got caught not wearing your helmet, and you were out in the open.
Was that for all regiments?
All, yes, right across the front. Oh. Well, for Canadian troops, anyway.
Yeah.
You didn't wear your helmet. It was just too many people get small injuries in the head and you know, they're out of battle.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Was there any trading going on with other UN battalions or Commonwealth battalions or the U.S. forces for rations and for weapons?
Well, I had the Pioneer Platoon. I had jeeps. Nobody bothered me. Even though I was only second lieutenant, I could go anywhere. That's it. I didn't have to ask permission, although I certainly did let headquarters know every time I went somewhere, sent dispatch to crew. And with that kind of mobility, and of course we had control of all construction material that came in to the front, or somebody needed a bunker, that was part of one of my sections, construction in. An 8 by 8 by 8 foot timber in cost in Korea was cost accounted at $35. I had a standard offer for all American truck drivers loaded with lumber, one bottle of scotch for one truckload of lumber. And it got to the point I had to stop this because we probably had the biggest lumber yard in Korea. And of course, my pack of bottles of scotch were only 90 cents. Okay, at that time, you could make this work. But the same with, and because we could get around, we could do this. So my battalion was fairly equipped with bunker material. With the Brits, now the Brits had better cold weather clothing than we did in that winter. And so first thing I could do was, and we, of course, Canadian Army had such a surplus of butter and cheese in Canada that they sent, instead of using cooking oil in Korea, we got all kinds of butter and that would just melt that down and use that for cooking oil. But we were the only army in Korea to have butter. So I could go down to, and we had lots of it, and I could go down and get one of these wooden boxes of butter just by saying I wanted it, and a box of cheese. Then I could go over to the British or the Americans trade. Well, with the Brits, I had my platoon equipped with cold weather equipment pretty quickly just by trading. Just trying, other than lumber, that's all I wanted from the Americans. Cold weather uniforms from the Brits.
What was the difference between the cold weather uniforms with the Brits and the Canadians? I know the Canadians had parkas.
No, we didn't have parkas. The British had parkas.
British had parkas.
We didn't take any of our cold weather equipment from Canada. We had it in Canada for cold weather training.
Yeah.
We went to Korea, we had our field service olive drab uniforms, you had battle dress, you had coveralls, and you had your greatcoat.
There was no...
That was it. There was no...
Really?
None of the stuff that we have for cold weather use in Canada was taken to Korea. Not by the infantry battalions, anyway.
Hmm.
So, but the Brits had it. So I created off butter, literally butter for them, and booze for the Americans.
Were they ever issued afterwards? Like, you know, a couple months?
I don't know.
No?
Huh. I never saw any.
Yeah. I don't know that. This is kind of a general question. How would you rate the Canadian Army's equipment for Korea overall?
Oh, it was good. It was World War II equipment at its best for the time. Other than the cold weather equipment, our guns, our tanks. It was all World War II equipment. Everything worked. And after the war was over, of course, they switched all the vehicles and took all the old ones out and put new ones in. But that was after the war, when it ceased, when it ended ceasefire.
So moving on to some questions about combat patrols and trench life. The hill that you, or the sort of the line that you were stationed was Jamestown Line, was that correct? The very first line?
I think it was.
And do you remember what hill you were first stationed at?
I was stationed at Tactical Headquarters.
Okay.
And I had all of the battalion area to look after for mines and booby traps. The final battle that I did was on 187,
yeah.
Which was the high casualty battle.
Well, I have a couple more questions before we get to that one. Can you explain to me how supplies were brought in up to the hills in different battalions?
They were brought into the from our B echelon, usually in trucks, right up to the company kitchens. Each company had its own kitchen in the rear, and supplies would then be offloaded into the company kitchens. Now, the problem is getting the food to the men in the front lines without moving them. So we had a huge army of Korean laborers that would literally carry the things forward to the troops at the front, and then turn around and take the equipment back down. They were not armed. They were just straight laborers carrying food and whatever supplies were needed to the front. And this would go on a daily basis.
Okay. I know you're based down in the HQ and headquarters, but do you think you could describe the standard routine on the line, like the wake-up, stand-to
rotation? Well, yeah. The standard routine, if nothing exciting is happening, is you keep guards, one guard in every trench at nighttime, and everyone is up half an hour before first light, because the first light is the very time for enemy to attack. And then a stand down about 2 hours later if you don't see any movement in the valley. And then pretty well for the rest of the day, you're either cleaning weapons, work parties, building new bunkers, putting out new wire, or sleeping. And again, at last light, you get stand two in the trenches for about half an hour before last light. Then about half an hour after last light, you leave one man in the trench, and they can turn over a couple hours sleep and you have to switch positions.
Okay.
And of course, unless the company's been ordered to send out a patrol, and if the company's been ordered to send out a patrol, they would usually get all ready in the afternoon, get their equipment, and then get at the front line ready to take off after last light, and then.
Okay. How was waste disposal dealt with? Was garbage ever, tossed out of the trenches at all?
Nope. You dig a hole, or latrines were dug into the side of a trench, and that would just be, about a couple of feet by a couple of feet deep, and open to the top, and put a couple of pieces of boards across the top, and sandbags on it. That's it. Of course, you dug a hole down, but garbage coming out of you don't want it flying all around your platoons and what have you. People do make inspections, even in the front lines, but bury it. Bury it in the rear area, bury it. There's all kinds of open spots on a platoon formation, usually. There were a lot, certainly in Korea, there was.
So they never take garbage and stuff out and bury it?
What's the point?
Oh, yeah.
Battlefield's a dirty place anyway. Half the shrapnel I got hit by, I'm sure, was old bones and probably rocks and
Was it ever tossed out of the trenches on the side, or is there?
I'm sure the soldiers do that all the time with their butts.
Yeah,
everybody smoked.
Yeah,
but you wouldn't throw paper stuff in front of your own position, a couple of feet away, you can bury it. It's not usual to make it, not in the Canadian Army anyway, it's not usual to make an unsanitary battlefield if you can avoid it.
What was your first experience in enemy combat? Was it the one at 187, or was there something prior to that?
I guess I was showing, along with some of my men, forward platoon one time, how to put in some new angle iron structures to give them better protection in their slit trenches. These angle iron structures were then covered with sandbags and so on. It enabled them to stand up under an bombardment rather than having to get down under cover with no overhead cover. An enemy sniper I'm sure it was all by sound. We aren't smoking or anything, but the darn bullet hit the angle iron, went right around, bang, bang, bang around. And I have it today. It didn't just drop, it spent itself. That was my first experience. And that was only the one shot. And there were four of us standing close together, and it didn't hit any of us. My second experience, of course, was 187. That was a very busy.
What was the protocol when artillery was fired at your position at the line, or in general?
Get the hell under cover.
Was there any return fire?
Well, of course, we had artillery observer, forward observation parties all throughout the line. And when artillery starts firing, the counter bombardment groups register where it's coming from. Everybody fires back. It gets very noisy. In fact, I know the 3rd of May, 53, it was so heavy that you talk about the fog of war. There was so much dust in the air, you could not see in front of this far in front of you. And the first few people I shot coming at me, I didn't know who was going to. I had to wait for the last second because I didn't know it was our guys, somebody running away, or past. It's very personal.
When did you conduct your first patrol?
In Korea?
In Korea, yeah.
I'm going to take a guess that it was probably the end of February 1953. Because we took... I did patrols in the rear area for about, a few days, and then we were ordered up to assist or learn what the Royal 22nd had learned. So then we were on patrols every night. So that would be, somewhere around the end of February of 53.
Every night?
Yeah.
Patrols?
Oh, yeah.
That's pretty regular. There's rest days, though?
No, not really. There's always something to do for the pioneer platoon anyway. But I wouldn't take the same men every night. Try and split it down, brief patrol in the afternoon and take them last night. But I was out almost every night. But my corporals and my privates were about every third night. But, there's always something for them to do during the day. There's ammunition, mortar bombs, tank rounds that don't explode. Pioneers have to take that stuff, get it to a rear area, properly explode it. So, you're not just sitting around during the day. There's always EOD to do.
Mm-hmm. It's a dangerous job, though.
That's why you have to select your men very carefully.
Yeah.
And train them very carefully.
Mm-hmm. How long were these patrols? You said from first light or first light out? Or?
Depends on what you're doing.
Yeah.
Fighting patrols. Proper fighting patrol was probably about 2-3 hours. or you might just have a patrol, a minefield patrol, might just take an hour and a half from the time you go out, time you come in. Mm-hmm. And of course, those were closer to our own lines, but then again, you don't know what the enemy's doing. You try to know. Mm-hmm. So you have to be just as careful whether you're painting minefield fences or actually looking for the enemy to set up an ambush.
Yeah. How often do these routes change? Do they change every night or sometimes?
You try never to use the same route twice in a row. Okay. You know, once the enemy gets, all they have to do is have one man with a radio and contact to artillery.
Yeah.
If you use the same route all the time, you wouldn't be around the second time, the third time.
Yeah.
I know we went out as pioneers, and they were pretty messy patrol routes, and the commanding officer wanted to change some of the routes. So I had to take my pioneers out to take all these booby traps off of the routes. That job I considered too dangerous to do at night. We did that in broad daylight. Careful with our camouflage and so on. But that was about a 5-hour job, just clearing one of these short routes. And then the pimple wanted to use, that was in front of 187, they wanted to use that for tanks. And it was all covered in booby traps and what have you. Every army had been there covered the pimple with booby traps. So we went on, we cleaned all that up in daytime. But that was, we did it from the rear so the tanks could get in there at night.
It was called the Bit Bulls?
Or Pimple.
Oh, Pimple.
Pimple.
Okay.
It's in front of 187, I was there. And so we cleaned all that area up and then stacked all the explosives to the side so we could go back another day and just blow them up.
Mm-hmm.
Hi. So then about half we got that position cleared, we then went and took all the mines out of a minefield to make a way for the tanks to get through without hitting the mines. So my pioneer platoon did that one night. And that was, made a little bit of noise. And I went to the one end of the minefield and with a red flashlight, shot light back. So I'm in front of the minefield. My men are coming towards me, making an 8-foot gap. And because there was so much metal in the ground, they couldn't use the mine detectors. So I had to prod every single step. So that took us about, I don't know, 5 or 6 hours. And I guess there was a little bit of noise being made. Not much, but I guess some Chinese sniper heard it. Or one of their guards on their side of the lines, which were a couple of hundred yards away. And all of a sudden I heard this, and that tells you there's an incoming mortar round. And you don't get a second chance. And I dove into inside a minefield, to a small pond area. It was a depressed area. It was filled with water. But right where I was standing, this mortar round, just the one round, landed. So somebody had my position pretty well pinpointed or something. And maybe I switched the light round. I hadn't thought of it or something. Even though it was a red light, and you can't see those very well at night, you have to know what you're looking at. Anyway, so it landed right where I was standing, but I didn't get other than get soaking wet. And my men eventually got through, and then the tanks came up. We guided them through and onto the temple, and then we were finished for the night. And the tanks sort of got their act together, and they crammed every single round they could into the tanks. And then in the morning at first light, they opened up on the Chinese. But that put them 400 yards closer to the Chinese than they had been the day before.
Mm-hmm.
And then that night, they pulled out. They were just there the one day, but they did an awful lot of damage in that one day.
Hmm.
And the troop commander got an MC for that action, and he eventually became a general.
Hmm. Wow. Besides the Hill 187, was there any other times you came into contact, or perhaps on patrol?
I came into contact
on patrol. Yeah, besides the one you just told me about, but a patrol with in contact with actual.
No, I got wounded 8 times that night, and I got captured, and by the Chinese.
Mm-hmm.
I got attacked later on by American aircraft.
Oh,
yes, I've been rocketed, strafed, and machine gun, but never by our own side, or never by the enemy. Well, that's not quite true. I certainly bombarded. I've got 5 shrapnel wounds, 2 grenade wounds, and a bullet wound. The ones that actually hit me.
So May 3rd, you said, was the night of the Defensive Hill 187?
Yeah. Yeah, it really started on the 1st of May, with bombardments and very intense. It was the most intense fire that the Canadian Army has ever been under in its whole history. Wow. It was, and the more casualties than it was. Yeah.
Had you been on patrol the night before?
Yeah. And I was. And that night I was, they had some unexploded rounds on 8 platoon, 7 platoon. And so we were up there to get rid of those. Mm-hmm. I went down to 7 platoon, but it was so much bombardment under there we couldn't get out, and I just took my men back from there to 8 platoon, and of course you're running alone in a bombardment, and we got stuck there with extra bombardment. We never did get around to doing anything to the unexploded rounds. Mm-hmm.
And that's when the Defensive Hill 187 started.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Can you tell me about the up to May 3rd, what was going on? Any memories, sort of things?
Well, just as I discussed, my platoon was doing its ordinary pioneer work, booby traps, putting them in, taking them out, destroying unexploded bombs, maybe putting in a bunker, maybe a culvert to divert water, helped the anti-tank platoon, had to dig their recoilless rifles down and get them safe, and went and blew, used explosives to blow bunkers for them. Mm-hmm. I need that and constant patrolling.
Okay. Can you explain to me what happened on May the 3rd? Of the Defense Hill 187?
Yeah. Well, I'm going to condense it a bit.
Okay.
Jerry Manel had been sent out with a fighting man patrol, and this is very heavily armed, and they're being very aggressive, and they're looking. And I said goodbye to him. I was going up the hill, and he was just waiting to start his patrol that night. I said goodbye to him, and took my men off in a different direction. And he got his patrol out, and unknown to him, the Chinese had set up an ambush, and he walked right into it, and he got shot in the head. And his men attempted to bring him back. Corporal McNeil got an MM for bringing the remainder of that patrol back in. Unfortunately, they came up in a valley between Charlie Company and the company on its right. As Jerry was attacked, platoon signaled with the signaler to the company, or to the battalion, that they'd been attacked, they're coming back in. That battalion commander then signaled Mons that the action in front of his company, he'd better send some help down to Jerry Manel's platoon. So I was with Doug Branton at the time. He had 18 men left. So he was sent with the 18 men. And I said, okay, I'll stay here with my 2 pioneers that I had with me and Corporal Peril and keep control of this platoon position. Well, Jerry Manel, or Doug Benton, just got over the edge of 7 platoon where Ed Ollier was commanding, and he got wiped out. But of course, I didn't know that because Doug had taken the radio with him and our radio. So I am sitting there with no communications, no telephone, no nothing. So we heard a rustle. I heard a rustle in the valley. So we challenged. And I found 2 forward counter-bombardment men from the Americans. I didn't even know we were on that platoon position. So I challenged the valley and got back that they were Canadians and they had the right call sign or return signal. So I said, okay, leave them alone. Little did I know the Chinese were following them in. Mm. So the patrol got into the company headquarters all right. Most of them did all right. But the Chinese patrol following them in came in from my rear. Next thing I know, I am 1 against I don't know how big the patrol was. So it's where I got some more wounds. I got wounded earlier in the evening on my left arm, and then I got a piece of shrapnel hit my helmet and went into my head. I wore that for a couple of weeks before I could wiggle it loose. I still have that piece too. But if I hadn't had the helmet on, it probably would have taken a good swath out of skull. So when it hit the helmet, it expended enough energy, so just enough left to it. And then later on, very shrapnel broke my shoulder, my right arm, my right hip, and hundreds of little, you don't even just, uniform, just riddled with stuff that, and one bullet. And I still don't know. The bullet must have been fired in desperation from a long way away, because a Chinese steel bullet. And for years, I thought that I was just getting charley horses in my leg. And what, in fact, was happening, the bullet had been able had enough energy to pierce the skin and rest right up against the nerve. So when it touched the nerve, I felt I was getting charley horse. I'd give it a massage. When the bullet moved away from it, the charley horse would stop. And they, whenever, I guess it was 2007, they were giving me a new right hip. And they x-rayed down, further down my leg than they'd x-rayed in the past. And the technician came out and said, "We have a replacement." And I said, "No, I was a soldier." And he said, "Oh, I'll account for the bullet in your leg." And I said, "What bullet? I never got shot by a bullet." And the x-rays, by the x-rays in that pile of pictures right there.
Yeah.
I said, "I never got hit by a bullet." What is this? So after my hip had healed, then I went back in the hospital and they took the bullet out.
So you had a bullet in your leg from 1953 to 2007.
That's incredible. I didn't know it was there. No one had ever x-rayed that part of my leg.
Well, so after those shrapnel wounds and then the bullet, that's when you got captured from the
patient.
Do you think you could explain that, the whole situation and the...
believe me, the air was so thick at that time from another bombardment that it would settle down, reasonably. But every time more bombardment, just stirred up again. And I talked to the two kind of bombardment guys and said, "Well, what's going on in your radio? And at least you've got a radio, and we can maybe use that to communicate if I have to from now on." But, of course, I didn't know that Doug Benton and his men had been wiped out, and I didn't know what was happening in the patrol in front, and we don't get any information. And so I went down about 10 feet, 15 feet past these artillery fellows, and then I start hearing somebody running towards me. So I just waited till the right moment and shot him and some of the people with him, and I got knocked out again, and I come to, and I got a bunch of people around me, but they're Chinese. And the only thing I think that saved my life and didn't get me shot on the spot was I had a second lieutenant, and we wore a brass pips on our shoulder, and they thought they had an American general. I could tell they were saying general or whatever words it's out of. So they took me back to their lines, made me walk all the way with all my wounds and everything. But that's,
And then, so how long were you a POW for?
That's a very hazy period. I don't know, really. I think I came back in October. The war had been over on the 27th of July, but the Chinese had said they were going to keep me. I wasn't being returned, and I was MIA, WIA, but nobody knew where I was. They didn't have a body, so they couldn't make it a KIA. So when the war ended on the 27th, there was some immediate prisoner exchanges, but not where I was. I think it was October I came back.
And were you in prison with other Canadians and Americans? Or
not originally. I was kept solitary for almost the whole time. And then about a week before the war ended, I was then taken out of solitary and put in with about 10 Americans and one Australian officer. Mm-hmm. And then I got very sick. My body was reacting to something that wasn't being good for me. And I managed to get into what they call a first aid group where everybody was wounded, but not being getting any care. It's just that it was isolating them. And then I was told to go and get a bath in the river. So, of course, I still had my uniform and what have you, and tattered and bits and pieces. So I stripped down on the side of this creek and got in the water. Now, I recognized the smell of the water as cyanide, so I guessed that there was a gold mine up the creek somewhere, that they were mining gold. So I thought, oh, this is good. I can get some of these bugs and stuff off of me and be very careful not to drink it and don't stick my head under it. So I got myself really sanitarily cleaned for the first time in months. Then when I came out of the creek, they gave me a towel, which is very unusual. What's going on here? And then a blue commissar uniform. You've seen the Chinese commissars with a white shirt with no collar and a blue suit. A hat. I still had my scarf. The only thing I kept off my uniform was my regimental scarf, which I still have. And a pair of Chinese Army running shoes. And then they said, okay, come up over the hill. And I go up over the hill. And there's a Chinese general commanding this thing there, and said, we're sending you back. Thank you. Well, when? Right now. All right. He says, you are going to take the Chinese ambulance convoy to Panmunjom. You're in charge. Oh, okay. So I said, they got newsreels and everything. They're making a big propaganda. He said, well, he was a general, not my general, but I better salute him. So I saluted him and held it for a second. And I guess the same thing was going through his mind. Oh, well, I better return the salute. So I then went with the interpreter. I'm still not believing this stuff, and it's sort of hazy. I get down over the hill, and there's 19 Chinese Molotov ambulances there, each with four not previously recorded prisoners of war, and every one of them was dead, or dying, not dead. I guess that they put me in that category. They put me in the lead ambulance in the co-driver's seat, and the driver introduced himself as a former bank clerk from Shanghai, and I was in command. So the interpreter standing outside the ambulance this time. I said, when can I go? He said, you're in command. Anytime you want. I said, go. So we went through a dozen Chinese checkpoints, and I guess it was the blue suit. That was it. We didn't stop for one of them. Now I saw the commissar suit. That was enough for them. So we get to Panmunjom. Spent the night there. The men didn't get out of the ambulance. I was the only one that got out, and they gave me a stretcher there to sleep on for the night. And the first light in the morning, I'm up in the ambulance again. I said, okay. Get out of here. Where's the map? I want a map. I bet those are all minefields out there. No map. No map. I got to meet some provost escort somewhere. No map. Go. All right. So, thank God I know minefields. I took the convoy right through a minefield. I saw an American outpost. It was about an hour away from where we left. I can't find a main road anywhere. So I said, an outpost. And so right through the minefield. And it looked like it was a path. It wasn't as dangerous as it would appear to be, not to me. Anyway, so took 19 ambulances right through the post, and I get there, and there's an American PFC duty, and he says, what are you doing here? I said, second up down door, I'm rocking in Bridgewater, and I've got 91 badly wounded, all nationalities, and I have to get these ambulances to a hospital on our side, so you can't go through here. I said, you've got a radio or a telephone, let's talk to somebody. No, no radio, no telephone. This is about 6 o'clock in the morning or so on. And he says, I'll be relieved before this afternoon. You'll just have to wait here or go back. And I said, if I go back, they'll shoot us for sure. That's the end of the problem. I said, no. I'm telling my driver to drive through the post and drive through that. And American says, I'll have to shoot if you do. I said, I tell you what, how many rounds you got? He said, 10. I said, okay, go and shoot the last 10 men in the convoy, and then you can say you defended your post to your last bullet. He said, you're crazy. And I said, that's right. I'm just crazy enough to drive through that barrier. These are ambulances. So the last second, lifts the barrier now. I said, okay, driver, stop. I told you I was an officer. Haven't you forgotten something? Thank you. I got a salute from him. Now, we drove for an hour and a half in the rear areas of the UN lines with 19 ambulances with big red stars on them, Chinese drivers. No, nothing with a Red Cross or anything on them. They identified them as ambulances. And I was looking for a Provo headquarters. I didn't really want a hospital. That would just cause confusion with all those casualties in the hospital, because they didn't all need hospitalization immediately. But I wanted somebody that was used to this kind of a situation. And I found American Provo Army headquarters, and the full colonel there, at Wujongbu. And I knew that they existed at Wujongbu because I'd been there before. So I pulled in to this Provo line, lined up the ambulances in the parking area, and this time a master sergeant is, or American, not master, anyway, top sergeant, standing on the hill. Well, I get out in my commissar suit and walk up the hill, and I said, I need to see the provost marshal right away. He says, what is this? And I said, there's 91 prisoners of war I'm bringing back. Most of them not expected to live, but we're all alive right now. Don't, you better come in. So I go into the office. There's a captain there. And I salute him and tell him who I am. And he says, what kind of a joke is this? I said, this is no joke. I have brought so-and-so, and I need to have the provost marshal settle this thing and get things moving right away. And then, of course, in the background, this top sergeant's gone. He's backing me up, but he can't say much because the captain is in absolute disbelief. The colonel, the provost marshal, thank God, came out of his office and said, again, is this some kind of a joke, mister? No, sir. And the sergeant again said, let's go down and see this. I don't believe this. Well, it's about 100 yards down the parking lot. And as soon as he got over there, he sees these ambulances with the red star, Chinese drivers standing beside each one. Oh my God. Says, turned around to the captain and says, get this thing organized. Get ambulances, helicopters, everything we need. And I said, thank you very much, sir. Now I'll just go down and get him one of the first vehicles that comes on. There you go. I handed him over to you. So then I got taken to an American facility, and then to a British facility, and two or three days later, to Canadian facility.
Wow.
Yeah. End of that story.
Did you get some credit for the...
No, I've never published the story. When I got back, the very first thing they did was read me the Official Secrets Act. Mm-hmm. I cannot talk about this, period. I've seen the report that was sent in, and it's half the stuff I told the intelligence officer, who eventually became head of the Canadian Armed Forces. Half of the stuff that I told him was not in there, and he didn't want to hear. He didn't, nope, I don't want that. You're back now, war's over. Well, you can see the word had already been sent down by Ottawa, is my guess, because the first two Westerners to get into China after the Korean War were a fellow called Trudeau and Marchand. Very first, I can see what was building up here. But in retrospect, they did not want my story. I got no credit, except you won't talk about it. And on the airplane back, I had a few men with me. They all had the same man. Bill Boss, the newspaper correspondent, was there. And he was persona non grata in my regiment anyway. And he kept trying to ask questions all the way back. And I said, the men cannot tell you. So he made up his own story for the newspapers. And there's a bunch of BS in there. Let's see what else happened. No, that was it. It was, so I never even started telling these stories till 4 or 5 years ago. Once they released the official debriefing that they did on me and declassified it, I said, as far as I'm concerned, but it's mm-hmm. it's only a quarter of the story. They either didn't want to publish or they didn't want to hear about it.
Yeah.
And maybe both, probably both. So you're hearing, so that story, it's, I've only told that story a couple of times before, bringing the convoy back. Obviously, the records of it exist, certainly in the provost marshal's office, the American, but,
Wow. That's a cool, it's a great story. I don't know, it's awesome. Just backing up quite a bit, I just need a couple clarification questions on the platoon command, as your time as a platoon commander. Can you tell me like your direct duties as a platoon commander?
Command the platoon, organize their training, mm-hmm. keep them trained, and I was left pretty much alone because I was the only one in the battalion that was qualified to teach explosives, booby traps, and I'd taken that training at the engineer school.
Mm-hmm.
So I had all my qualifications, and I just set up my own training plans, organized explosives training, how to build bridges. We could build bridges, blow them apart, build structures, blow them apart,
mm-hmm.
hydraulics involved in road engineering, using rope to advantage, anything to do with moving anything. Anything an engineer does in civilian life was, that's in a small scale what I was doing, but with very rough equipment that you could find in a field.
And what would you consider the greatest challenges and difficulties of that position in your role?
Keeping your men alive. I was extremely careful on how I selected men. I trained a lot of men and sent them off to other locations, but the ones I kept with me had to be safety conscious but not afraid. They had to know they'd be confident in their duties. And it's rather interesting that most of my platoon came from Nova Scotia. Not only was it a big recruitment area for the Army, but a lot of them had some experience in the mines. They were quite safety conscious, and you didn't have to frighten them with stories of them. One, you don't make any mistakes. You don't take shortcuts. You don't do it right and do it once. And I never lost a man, except me. wasn't really a platoon duty I was involved in.
Yeah. Well, fair enough. Got some questions about the Korean soldiers. How often would you say we were in contact with local Koreans besides the porters and Korean service corps? Civilians, per se.
Never.
Never? Okay.
No, hardly ever.
Yeah.
When we first went in the rest area, before I went up to the Royal 22nd Regiment, there were a lot of women on the outsides of the barbed wire selling what they sell.
Fair enough. What was the relationship like between the Canadians and the CATCOM troops?
I think it was very, very friendly. CATCOM, that's our laborers. Those are our laborers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it was very, very friendly. I certainly never had any problem with them. They were usually joking among themselves, and very few Canadians spoke any Korean at all. We all picked up some, catchwords here and there, but it was a friendly relationship. CATCOMs were getting money to send home. They were getting food, which they wouldn't have got otherwise. Food was a very difficult thing for civilians in Korea to get at that time.
Mm-hmm.
So,
would you say was there any racism among the foreign troops, not the Canadian troops per se, towards the CATCOMs, the civilians?
I never saw any racism. I saw lots of American and Australian troops, British troops, but I never noticed any.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I'm going to go into some literature questions about stuff that's been written on the key involvement. Much of what I've read on the Canadian involvement in the Korean War depicts a kind of a fighting force that was not prepared. So that's mostly with the from 1951 to 1952. What are your thoughts on this?
Well, the men were mostly taken from the militia. Mm-hmm. And the officers had been World War II officers. They'd been, we used the term recycled at the time, which but it's true. For one of, they were all very well qualified. The selection process was very thorough for the officers. It was pretty good for the men. I'm not too sure what the exact percentage was of World War II veterans, but there are an awful lot of them. Most of the NCOs had been in, and then they were in the militia, and it was the militia. They were activated into the special forces. So when Big Jim Stone commanded the Patricias, when he went to Korea first, even though they had been training in Fort Lewis, Washington for quite some time, he didn't consider that the men were up to the standard that he needed. So he refused, and he was backed up by the Canadian generals with, not until I say they're ready, they won't go in the hand. For Cap Young, that's when he put them in the line. Mm-hmm. But when he said they were ready, then they were ready. And it was a while after that before the other two infantry battalions and of course arrived front. But a lot of the men were, well, I had my men for almost 3 years of training before I took them to Korea, so I know how well trained they were and capable of their job. But I was fortunate that way. Not all the men in the battalion were that. We kept getting drafts that we had to fill all the time. And I had my commanding officer's blessing. I will not send a trained pioneer to be as an ordinary infantryman. It just takes too long to train them well. So I didn't send any of my, except one. He got killed the second day he was there. So I just refused to, with my commanding officer's backing, no more pioneers are going to Korea. Not if they're going to be used as infantrymen. Mm-hmm. So.
Have you read much literature on the Korean War? And what are your thoughts on that?
I've read quite a bit of it.
And what are your thoughts, like general thoughts on the greatest opinion on the things that you've read with the Canadian involvement?
Well, I think we did a good job. Mm-hmm. The limitations we had, and we had extremely good commanders. We're fortunate that way. I think all the commanding officers that I can think of were all very competent, all had experience. I know mine had joined the Canadian Army in 39, had been all through Italy and what have you, and mountainous terrain there, mountainous terrain in Korea. Battalion second in command, all the company commanders had World War II experience, and I would say half the officers. I was one of the few that didn't have World War II experience. A good half of the men had World War II experience, but they had to learn to work together, and this was once. Do things together.
Fair enough. What limitations, if they existed, what do you think the greatest limitations would be to the Canadian involvement in the Korean War?
Well, we had a terrible time with water. I mean, most of the water, you'd probably get less chlorine than the Clorox said to have. Sorry, that was terrible. So, yeah, but we were entitled to a liter of beer a day. So that's where you got mostly real at the front. Some soldiers did not drink. Some got more than a liter a day.
Was it Japanese beer or Korean beer?
Japanese.
Like Asahi or?
Yeah, Asahi. Yeah, you want to be, at that time, we told to be warned to be careful of Korean beer. Don't touch it because some of it was poisonous to us. Mm-hmm. But water, although we had a engineers could make potable water, but there was an awful lot of chlorine that we could make it with our trucks, but hardly anyone touched it. It was beer. Or use that water, you didn't need to put any bleach in it. You wanted to wash your own clothes rather than use the mobile laundry and bath unit, where you would just turn in your clothes and pick up clean ones at the other end once you got through the showers. What else was there? Yeah, I think we were pretty well supplied with, except on the winter clothing and that wasn't good enough clothing. And but other people did the same thing I did when just we had so much butter and cheese, you could trade it, and people, all the other armies,
yeah,
would take it.
What would you say was your greatest asset that you could trade for? Would it be the scotch, or would it be the butter?
Butter.
Butter was the most sought after.
No other army got butter.
Like you
said. And not everyone wanted scotch or stuff. Mm-hmm. You could get beer.
And what was the most sought after piece of equipment or food item from other UN troops or American troops?
Well, I'd say winter clothing.
Winter clothing? Okay.
Winter clothing was probably the most. Although we did a lot of lumber. Lumber was very hard to come by. Mm-hmm. And but the Americans used to import a lot of it and do some trading for a load of lumber.
Yeah. Just the last couple of questions. How often did you and your troops get a leave of duty to go into Ishan or Seal or just outside the lines? Never.
No. Never. Because at that time, Seal had been overrun by and then pushed back. They were having terrible times, although I could get into Seoul. But I had reasons to do it, and the command officer probably winked because he knew I was going into the British Navy to buy booze, but that was to trade stuff with me. It wasn't for me. When the war was over, I was then given a jeep. I was in Korea for a couple of weeks and doing debriefings on. I was given a jeep and driver, and in fact, it was rather interesting. When I got back, I started, my first meal consisted of steak, 6 eggs, a great big chocolate sundae, a liter of orange juice, a liter of beer. When I finished that, I said, do it again. I hadn't had anything to eat. And that was my cure. That was my cure. And I went to sleep for about 18 or 20 hours. It was about 10 o'clock at night. And so I knew there had to be an officer's mess somewhere, so I got dressed and found the officer's mess. And of course, I didn't have any money in my pocket or anything. I hadn't seen anybody other than the Americans. So I went down to the mess, and there's a full colonel there with his red tabs and some other people. And we had been used to using any officer's mess in the armed forces, in Commonwealth forces, just signing a chit. Eventually it would catch up and your paymaster would pay the thing out. Well, I ordered a scotch, and bartender asked me for money. I said, "No, just give me a chit." He said, "Oh, we stopped that system a couple of months ago." I said, "Oh," and of course, I haven't got any stars on my shoulder. I just look like a pirate soldier walking into a bar. And the colonel says, "Who are you?" I said, "I got down at all." He said, "You haven't got any stars?" I said, "No, I just got out of North Korea this morning. I haven't got a chance to get any equipment yet." He said, "What? You just got?" I said, "Yeah." I put it on my bill. So I had a few drinks and then went back to bed and got up in the morning and the briefing started again. Anyway, and I found the paymaster, of course, that could be authorized. "How much money do you want?" I said, "I want $200, which is a lot of money in 53. And he said, "No, I maybe give you £5. So I'll give you £5 now, but I'll have to write a message on this. I'll have to go through." Well, that sure went through fast, because that was in the morning. By noontime, he had an answer to the message. "Give Second Lieutenant Owen all the money he wants." And that's all the authority. So I got my $200.
Yeah.
And then, oh, yes. So I was down at the British Navy buying some booze. And a bunch of the American officers that I'd spent a couple of weeks with before I got returned came in, and they all had a Provo escort. "What's happening to you guys?" I mean, he's like, "No, we're not permitted to have any spicy foods, any liquor, any." He said, "What are you doing?" I said, "Oh, well, we operate a little different in Canada. I got my jeep, I got my driver, at $200. So I kept in touch with some of them for years afterwards. Americans that
yeah,
most of them are passed away now.
Mm-hmm. Wow. And did you go back to did you go to Japan on the way back for Canada?
Well, I guess I was. This is pretty hazy. I know I spent a couple of weeks in Korea getting debriefed, and then one day they said, "Okay," he gave me a light aircraft and sent me to Kimpu Airport. And then I got a converted DC-3 Qantas Airways plane to Tokyo, and they put me in a hotel, services hotel at Iwakuni. It had been a former Japanese naval training center. I guess I was there for a week. They gave me a private room on my own. I said, don't call us, we'll call you. Just get your meals. I saw a good portion of Tokyo. We had a section in Tokyo that used the facility, and went around and saw a few bars, and then one day he said, okay, taking you out of the airport, you're flying back to Canada, you don't have to wait for the boat. So that's great. And got on the airplane, and we made a record crossing flight of the Pacific. We landed refueling in an airport in Shemya, I think, Alaska. And then down to Vancouver, where we stopped. And the plane was carrying on to Seattle. Sitting beside me, I had an American full colonel who was retiring. And I started drinking cognac, I remember. Second lieutenant, and the girl Stewart is bringing me cognac, but every time he has a drink, he has to pay $2. So after a while, he says, I notice this officer beside me is not paying for his drinks. She said, oh no, it's all right, he's on a first class ticket. He said, and I said, no, you're just the normal tourist ticket, sir. And of course, what had happened, a whole bunch of Japanese passengers had occupied the first class ticket section. So all the Canadians were on first class tickets, but we were interspersed with the by the other people on the airplane. But so our drinks were free, but anybody else had to pay for them. Well, when we got to Vancouver, the plane sits on. It was a record breaking flight. We were like 2.5 to 3 hours ahead of schedule, and the newspaper reporters that were there to meet me hadn't arrived yet, and my family had arrived. They all lived in Vancouver. So we're sitting there on the tarmac. The colonel calls the steward and says, why are we waiting here on the tarmac? Wait, let's get the pilot down here. I'll tell him to go. He said, oh no, they've got an important person on board, and they're not ready to receive him yet. He said, oh, who's that? I said, second lieutenant. Oh. So I'm holding up the airplane because the newspaper reporters are not there. I didn't know that. I know my whole family was there, but my wife, a couple of the kids, and there's a picture of them in there. Mm. My mother, uncles, yeah, that's right. Uh-huh. Anyway, so then I got off the airplane and it took off.
That's awesome. The colonel wasn't too happy, especially with his bar tab.
Well, yeah, I suppose $2. And those were the days of 10-cent beer. Now you pay $5 and $7 for it. So you get some idea of the way the politicians have screwed up the currencies.
Yeah. Well, that's a good story. That's all the questions I have. All the questions.
You want to look at any of those pictures and ask a question?
Yeah, for sure.
Unfortunately, a fellow by the name of Cameron, who did an interview with me 3 years ago, never returned all the stuff that I had taken back to look at.
Let's see,
what have we got here? Okay, that's just me and my officer training days, 1948 at Calgary Barracks.
Oh, yeah, in Cree Barracks?
Cree Barracks in Calgary, yeah.
Okay. And we got this one here. It's just two.
Oh,
it's like a postcard one. Yeah.
It's like the same stuff.
Well, you mentioned to me that you did.
Oh yeah, I mentioned I learned to fly.
Yeah, you said was this in Switzerland?
No. Actually, that's I was on the ski patrol in the North Shore Mountains, mm-hmm. and that's about 44, 42, 43, somewhere in there, skiing there. That's just me and my wife, early days, in Curry Bearings. This would be about 1944, when I was in the C-400s. And that was about to become my wife here.
Yeah, very pretty. That's you in your uniform?
That's me, yeah. Short Curry Bearings.
Yeah. And these are...
various...
Well, I'll turn the...
There's various things... This is a...
Say what, I'll just do the concluding sentences and we'll go over this.
All right.
Then I can really go through this stuff. So, just have to state this to the thing. I'll just grab a pen. This concludes the Military Oral History Program interview with Charles Gordon Owen on March 12th, 2015. And I was going to say, but that was good. You've been provided with the Military Oral History Release Form?
Yes, all right.
You just have to sign at the bottom. Right. Oh, you have to put your name first. Should have done it before.
How do I fill that
out? Yeah. You just got to sign it.
Be having your event on the following dates. Today's the 12th.
Yeah.
12,
and you are the. We have both signed the interview release form, is that correct?
Yes.
All right. Well, this concludes our interview. Thank you very much for your time. It was a pleasure to meet you.
Okay, I'll show you what these other things are.
Hold on, I'm going to turn this off. That's
right.